Hey, this is Ed. So this is a podcast, is that right?
This is.
Okay. We're officially podcasting right now. That's awesome.
This is Straight from the Cutter's Mouth.
Welcome to Straight from the Cutter's Mouth, a retina podcast. At least once a week, do we aim to bring you insights and perspectives from the world of vitreoretinal surgery. I'm your host, Dr. Jay Schreather. Today, on episode 217, I have the pleasure of being joined by Dr. Farina Ali to discuss the March 2020 edition of Retinal Physician. This issue focuses on extended durability anti-VEGF agents and similar agents. So we discuss three articles about three different kind of paths. First, we talk about the port delivery system for ranibizumab. We talk a little bit about an antibiotic biopolymer conjugate, KSI-301 for retinal disease, and end by talking a little bit about sunitinib malate for neovascular age-related macular degeneration. As always, this episode and all prior episodes can be found on our website. You can see a list of financial disclosures attached in the episode description. And remember, you can claim CME credit for this episode and many other episodes on the American Academy of Ophthalmology website. Simply click on the link in the episode description. That'll take you to the AAO website where you can claim about a half CME credit per episode. Straight from the Cutter's Mouth is now happy to be joined by Dr. Farina Ali from Dallas, Texas to discuss the March 2020 issue of Retinal Physician. And Retinal Physician is available for free online and in print at retinalphysician.com. And thanks again to the team at Retinal Physician letting us preview this in a couple days in advance of the March 2nd release online. Farina, thanks for joining me.
Thanks so much, Jay. It's great to be back.
So this is a issue focusing on quote-unquote new pathways, and it's talking about kind of extended durability anti-VEGF or extended durability medications. Of note, this is a industry-sponsored articles, many of these, and you know they're very open. The articles each have, each of the kind of authors kind of are investigators, receive research funding, and from each of the companies that produce these medications or agents. But what we're basically here to do is kind of review them. We're not going to go through the articles point by point. If you want to read the articles, you can read them online for free. But the first article we're going to talk about was Port Delivery of Ranibizumab by Nancy Holekamp, MD. We've talked about the port delivery system a ton on this podcast. This is studied in the latter phase 2 trial. It essentially is an external port, that is, a reservoir that is put in surgically, and then afterward can be refilled as needed with anti-VEGF and releases it over a sustained period of time. Kind of the biggest take-home points from the latter study is they had different criteria based on OCT when to refill. And the patients who met refill criteria, they needed about 8.8 months as the median time to their first refill. So there definitely was good durability demonstrated in the latter trial. They're doing a phase 3 trial, Archway, right now. And again, biggest thing we see, first of all, efficacy, and then, of course, safety. So this is, and they talk about this towards the end of the article, this is a surgical procedure being incorporated into something that was always treated medically in the office. And they talk a little bit about vitreous hemorrhage was something that was noted early in the latter clinical trial. And talk a little bit about endophthalmitis, which is always a concern when you talk about an externally implanted device. So, Farina, let's talk a little bit about the first point about vitreous hemorrhage. They mentioned that there were certain things that were revised. They decreased the vitreous hemorrhage rate to about 4.5%. Vitreous hemorrhage is not unusual after retinal surgery and secondary implants. I mean, it's one of the things even with secondary lenses that are described, whether it's a modified Yamani technique or a sutured lens with accuracy, there is a rate of vitreous hemorrhage that's there. Vitreous hemorrhage that clears is not as big an issue. Is 4.5%, I mean, I view that as 4.5%, assuming it's moderate hemorrhage that clears, that's not an unreasonable percentage, right? I always think about what would be kind of the percentage at which I'm like, maybe I don't want to do this.
Yeah, I don't think it's an unreasonable percentage. I mean, I think initially they were looking at 50% and the trial was halted, and they, you know, very thoughtfully came up with a new surgical technique to address the issue that definitely had, you know, a cause relationship effect. I think 4.5% is reasonable. I'd be curious to know, and I think it would be hard to kind of find this out regarding the rates of vitreous hemorrhage with something like a Retisert. The incision for the two devices are in length and size is quite similar. So I would imagine the rates would be similar, but because Retisert is, you know, at this stage of the game, so infrequently used, I think it would be hard to get a good estimate of that. But I think if there were a benchmark, it would be that. The difference, of course, with the port delivery system is that, you know, the the implant itself stretches open the sclera, and it maintains a kind of opening of the sclera that is then filled with the, with the kind of flush to the sclera, the kind of face of the implant. So I think that's a little bit different than something like a suture lens or a retisert where the sclera is closed. So I think there's thought to be some relationship with that stretch and the rates of hemorrhage. All of that being said, I think that the returns that you can get from it and the durability that you can get from it, I think far outweigh the rates of vitreous hemorrhage that are seen in this and other vitrectomy procedures, like you're saying.
You know, the other big complication that anyone worries about, as I mentioned, with an external implant is endophthalmitis. They had a rate of 1.7%. Again, trial numbers are always big numbers, but small in real world terms. So it's three cases out of 179, about one in 60, which is much higher than what we get with injections, which ranges in the study you look at from 1 in 2,500 to 5,000. Now, again, there are probably modification techniques that may help reduce this. And again, this is, we'll get more data from Archway about how common this is. They also talk about blebs or erosions in almost 7% of patients. I mean, for me, I'll be honest, I don't have a dog in this race, but the one thing I'd be most concerned about with a permanent implant would be sort of an infectious risk in an older population. And again, the question would be, this becomes a tougher question. I think 1.7 is probably too high, and hopefully there's modifications in the next trial which help reduce that. But it kind of becomes more an interesting question philosophically for a patient, for a physician. If you're talking about, well, this thing only needs to be refilled every 9 to 12 months, but your infection rate is, I don't know, 2 times higher, 5 times higher, 10 times higher than with injections, at what point is, you know, then it comes a question of repeated injections, there's risk with an endophthalmitis versus a single time, there's risk of endophthalmitis. I'm curious, again, what we'll see in terms of everyone's kind of appetite for what's so kind of the tipping point in terms of risk there.
Definitely. I think that there is a lot, you know, from my kind of impression and sort of discussion in the community, there's a lot of excitement, of course, about the durability and the treatment burden. I think that safety profile remains always a question, because we are so privileged in the field and that we have such a good drug that's so safe as it stands right now. You know, we're not getting as much time out of it as I think as we would like. But initially, you know, it sort of revolutionized the field. We're just looking for more and better at this point. I think the rate of infection, it becomes a very difficult comparison to compare an implanted surgical device to an in-office intravitreal injection based on the technique of the surgery and sort of the conjunctival related factors, which I think are far more significant than any kind of rate of vitreous hemorrhage. It makes it more analogous to a glaucoma drainage device in some way. Certainly there's no opening to the, you know, for drainage like a glaucoma device, but I think some of the risks are quite similar. And I think the appetites around it, to me, are more related to that kind of product than an intravitreal injection. And really, it may amount to the risk tolerance of the patient, even as well as the physician, in terms of, you know, what you might get out of it, with understanding that it may, you know, a surgically implanted device may never be as safe as an intravitreal injection. And that's just a known cost around this product.
Yeah. And so it'll be very interesting to see what happens with Archway as we go forward. You know, another paper that was written up in Retinal Physician, actually by one of our mentors, Carl Rogillo, was talking about an antibody biopolymer conjugate for enhanced durability in retinal disease. This is KSI-301. It's so early, it doesn't have a cool name yet, though I'm sure it'll have a cool name. That's how you know when something is just brand new. And so this is super early what they're talking about. They talk about phase one data, 9 patients with DME. Remember, phase one trials, for listeners, purely just safety, not really so much efficacy. So sometimes you have reported kind of efficacy, but it has to be taken with a grain of salt. It's never powered for the kind of to demonstrate sort of the primary outcome of an efficacy issue. It's more just to make sure it's safe and well-tolerated. And again, the big thing is no reports of intraocular inflammation, no drug adverse events, which were a total of 338 doses. And they did show that there was an improvement in treatment and that there was this, again, looking at the durability, there was an extended durability with not 100%, but almost 100%. Over 90% of these eyes were able to extend 3 months or longer, which is excellent in comparison, again, extrapolating small numbers to big numbers compared to data we have from approved drugs, which in trials is maybe about a third, you know, depending on the trial and the agent you look at, can extend to 3 months. And then they're also looking at DME. And they have a nice little diagram showing the biggest difference. I mean, this is right. an antibody, but it's got this huge kind of attachment to it. So it's a much larger molecule. To put it in context, mm-hmm. brolucizumab and ranibizumab are 26 and 48 kilodaltons respectively. Aflibercept's 115. This is 950 kilodaltons. So this is like nine times the size, or eight to nine times the size of aflibercept. So it's a bigger molecule for sure. So that's one of the reasons sustained is it has a super high concentration that's achievable. And so right now they're going to kind of talk about going forward with phase 2 data. So again, we just have to wait and see what the DAZZLE study, which is kind of the next big study, shows. Mm-hmm. But I'm curious, Farina, you know, big molecules, one of the things that's been discussed before with big molecules is there's advantages and there's disadvantages. One of the disadvantages been thought about is maybe there's a concern for more inflammation. At some point you get so mm-hmm. big that there's more of a reaction to this. Any sort of things you think about when you see this bigger size besides that?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I would have expected even in these early trials for there to be perhaps a higher rate of inflammation just by nature of the size. I think that what we've seen is as there is like molecular deviation from the basic antibody fragment of ranibizumab, whether it be smaller and greater concentration, like something like brolucizumab, or entirely larger, like aflibercept and some other depot-related products that we'll probably talk about in just a moment, we do see that there is an effect on how well the eye is able to kind of clear that. So I'm, you know, really surprised to see that such a large molecule, you know, in essence is described as sort of inert in some ways. I think that, you know, with a larger patient population in these trials, we'll learn more. I think the enrollment criteria always plays a bit of a role in how well tolerated sometimes these drugs can be in sort of an ideal case scenario. So yes, it will be very interesting to see, but you know, outside of that, if there's something unique to this that's allowing it to not cause much inflammation in the eye, then this is certainly really very exciting. And I'll really look forward to seeing these results. And you know, the other thing that I think is interesting is how the science of it is based off of an extended ocular half-life that this particular biopolymer conjugate allows. So I think the science is also very interesting.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting to think about. These are all different ways, right, to kind of get sustained delivery. So you can go a different pathway, but you're saying we have a pathway that's very, very efficacious, and we're just trying to make it last longer. So maybe not necessarily targeting the non-responders, which are much less frequent, mm-hmm. but really saying, hey, mm-hmm. we're going to double down on the, you know, Marina anchor showing this humongous swing in efficacy and shifting the field in terms right. of being able to treat wet AMD. Let's double down on that and see, like you said, can we get this longer half-life, greater durability? And the port delivery system's a different way of doing that. It's interesting mm-hmm. to kind of see this strategy. And it ties a little bit into the last medication we'll talk about in a second, which is sunitinib, malate for mm-hmm. neovascular AMD. This was written up by Arshad Khanani and co-authors. And sunitinib, this is a gray bug vision, and this is a little different. It's actually a depot that's mm-hmm. injected, and then it's released yeah. by the depot over time. So the actual microparticles that are acting are small, but you have this larger depot that's kind of sitting in there and releasing this. So it's not so much a large molecule, and it's not a port, but it's the same sort of idea of the sustained release over time. Now, mm-hmm. looking at kind of the trial data, there definitely is some efficacy that's been shown. It inhibits all VEGF receptors A through D, and it does seem to, at least in an animal model, kind of really mm-hmm. last for months in the vitreous, well above where you'd want kind of your dose of drug in the vitreous to be, your concentrations to be, to get inhibition of these receptors. So there's ongoing trials. There are some issues in terms of the particles they briefly talked about, because mm-hmm. these particles can go where you don't want them to go, which is usually the anterior chamber and cornea for retina specialists. Your thoughts on this, you know, I think that every kind of, there's pros and cons to every single delivery. You talked about the cons of a port delivery system, cons erosion, infection risk, the mm-hmm. cons of a larger molecule, maybe more inflammation. This is more inflammation, but like you said, maybe there's issues with the anterior chamber, trabecular meshwork, dispersion to places you don't want this to go, removal in cases maybe where you things aren't going well, maybe, I don't know about removal. I always think about worst case scenario, if you had to remove this, how would that go? Any sort of things that come to your mind? Again, this is all super early data, so we have a little less to talk about in terms of meat, in terms of actual efficacy here.
Right. So, I mean, I think this is also very interesting. All three of these articles really highlight, again, like what an exciting time it is in retina and all of the advancements towards, you know, doubling down on what we know to work and being creative with that. I think the interesting thing about this one is that initially it is injected, you know, in its particulate form, and then it aggregates in the eye. And so what they reported, I believe, in their phase 1-2A is that 30% of the patients didn't have complete aggregation. And then those particles can then migrate to the anterior chamber. So what they're now doing with their 2B is they formulated it a bit differently to allow for better aggregation, which, you know, I think is compelling. The durability itself is hugely compelling. So if this newer formulation proves to kind of be more cohesive in the way that it's needed to be to allow sustained release, I think that's really exciting. The flip side to it will always be that the path of least resistance for retina specialists is always going to be what we know to work safely, right?
Sure,
so if
sure.
we have patients that, you know, come in with inflammation from any of these products, whereas our clinics have been so optimized towards patients coming in, coming out, and getting their treatment and going home, if you're, you know, beginning to evaluate the anterior chamber, treating with steroids, doing tapers and things like that, it changes the ball game quite a bit, even if you're getting 6 months or whatever. Yeah.
And I don't want to step into this issue because I just got off a phone call talking for the podcast about brolucizumab, which is, you know, there's been some inflammatory issues, and that will release a couple of days before this episode comes out. So probably the listeners already heard
gotcha.
That one by the time they're hearing this. And we don't talk about that, but that's that's kind of the issue that we're talking about. There's two kind of issues. One is we already have existing treatment that works for most patients, right? So that's a great
right.
thing, but it's a different sort of conversation, right? So if this was 2005 and this was ranibizumab, and it worked tremendously well, but they're like, well, you have to monitor for inflammatory events, do all this. I think it would probably, we'd all be like, okay, we need to do this, because if we don't
sure,
do this,
yeah.
they're gonna go, patients are gonna go blind. It's a harder question now if you're like, well, I could give you this, and I can give you injections that are every 4 or 5 weeks, and you'll be fine if you come in every 4 weeks for injection, or I could do this injection, it will last 5 months, but there's a 5% chance you may have to come in, and there's a 0.1% chance you may have this issue. I mean, then it gets a really murky, and that's part of what we have to do is guide patients, because they're not going to always, some patients, very few patients are going to know all those risks and make educated decisions. Most patients are going to look at us and be like, well, what would you do?
And right.
It's
yeah.
going to be a much more complicated discussion. It's kind of like life. I don't think there's going to be a perfect option. And it's, again, it's really tough to we have good treatment now. It's really tough to break into a space for any of these drugs that already has good treatment. So you either have to offer increased efficacy, which is super difficult, or increased
sure,
durability.
Yeah.
And now we're seeing all the cons of increased durability. I don't know what the right answer is. And that's why I talk about the tipping point for each of these things. Like mentally, I'm thinking, at what point is, well, what durability, like if this is my mom, at what durability point is it worth it to take a risk that she may have inflammation, may need to be on drugs to come in? I don't know. And it probably depends on how old she is, depends on her functioning. It depends on lots of things,
right.
but having patients come in for checks for inflammation too is another, you know, treatment burden. And so part of the treatment burden is not just getting the shot, it's coming in to get your visits. And if you have to come in to constantly be monitored, that's an issue as well.
Right. I mean, I was talking with an industry colleague just the other day, and his comment is that retina specialists in a good way have gotten so spoiled with, you know, the cadre of drugs that we already have, which is really great, but it's a blessing, but in some ways from an innovative standpoint, it's a bit of a curse since the standards are so high, as you've described really well.
Right.
But
and
it's
I
fascinating
think,
and interesting.
And doctors, doctors and retina specialists are no different than being physicians. We're just conservative by nature, right? So you need to,
you need to
exceed the burden of proof, right? This is not, you're not innocent until you're proven guilty. When you're trying to present a new drug, you're kind of doing the opposite. You have to prove that you're not a problem.
And we're
fickle in a way, but we're also super loyal, right? So once we find something that works, then we tend to stick to it, and then it takes a while to kind of make us change to something new. And again, it's a very different conversation if you're talking about, hey, this is Luxturna, there's no existing therapy for your child with Leber's Chylomicronosis. It's $950,000. We're like, okay, well, or $850,000. We're gonna figure it out. We're like, we'll figure out the financial part of it, but we need to do this. It's very, very different here. And so I don't know. I don't know. I wonder, I don't know where it's going to go. I wonder what you think about this. I feel like we're going to end up treating drugs that kind of address multiple pathways or using multiple. I feel like that's probably going to be the way to go until gene therapy hits prime time, if it ever hits prime time. But I'm sure there will be inflammation and other issues of gene therapy as well.
And do you think that will include a pre-testing kind of criteria? Because that has been mentioned to me in different conversations, and we don't do that now. And to me, that feels burdensome to be doing pre-testing when I know I could probably use the drug that I have and be just fine. And the patient is, you know, at the end of the day, they often, treatment burden is a reality, no doubt. Undertreatment is a reality, no doubt. But I think lots of physicians would argue that our patients will often do what we tell them to do outside of certain criteria and certain socioeconomic limiting kind of factors. And so to throw in pre-treatment into the mix makes me think, well, maybe I'd rather do what I've been doing, you know?
Yeah,
but
you know,
it
so
will inform gene therapy, though, I think, in some other ways.
I feel the only field in medicine that can kind of talk about this in a similar fashion, but there's obvious huge differences in oncology, right? So oncology is another space where there's a lot of money being invested in these very specialized antibodies, and there's now this, you know, if you were an oncologist, my dad was an oncologist, you were an oncologist 25 years ago, your options of therapies were much simpler than if you're an oncologist in 2020. And now, and so a lot of times now, genetic testing of the tumor is like the most important thing, right? If you know that the genetics of the tumor, then you pick kind of personalized therapy. That's the future and the dream for oncologists. Every single patient is kind of an individualized therapy. But at least right now, you can sort of divvy up patients depending on the genetics and mutations that you find. Now, the obvious difference there is those old chemo agents had much higher side effect profiles, right? So this would be like, hey, ranibizumab gives you nausea and vomiting for 2 weeks and makes your hair fall out. Well, then it's probably worth me getting pretested to make sure, hey, new agent X, which doesn't have this side effects, but is much more expensive, maybe doesn't carry that same side effect profile. And there's no life or death here. So vision's super, super important, but most people, even though there's a decreased, I know there's decreased life expectancy with blindness, it's not the same as, hey, you have a 10% greater chance of living to 5 years if you get this treatment. So the real question is, there's a day-to-day practicality. Are we going to be able to do this? Are we even able to do this in an efficient manner? But from a cost perspective, should we be, are we really going to be testing every single patient who comes in with diabetic macular edema before starting them on treatment? I don't know. I think what you said is more accurate. Yeah. You're probably going
to
go by your standbys.
And that's the cost
to
the
ahead.
Right. No, sorry. I was just thinking about the cost to the healthcare system as well in and of itself. As, you know, time goes on, we're going to be accounting for that more. So it's hard to see that on the horizon where we're doing that testing like you're describing.
I mean, let's talk about, I mean, the election's going on right now. I mean, the costs are already overwhelming to the system, right? Like, it's not like we're in a good place and we're like, hey, it'll be more in the future.
No,
already
sure.
Going bankrupt,
but
right?
There'll be more scrutiny. Yes, yeah, for sure.
So,
definitely.
Like, it's like this, on one hand, we're going to meetings and we're talking about, hey, we're going to reduce costs. And then the next talk is about this drug or agent or trial or therapy. And it's really hard because we want the best possible outcomes for people. We don't want to be like, hey, we're not going to do this because it costs too much for you. But this is the question, is like, how much added benefit does it have relative to the cost it provides and the burden it provides? And I don't know, but that's a really good question about testing, because that probably would be the best way to do it. But then the question is, how do you even test patients? Is it a blood test? Is it a vitreous sample, anterior chamber sample? There's a ton of unanswered questions. And I think these trials, which are super large and hard to do, it's hard to even get 500 patients for phase 3 trial. That still the numbers are so low. We're seeing this with brolucizumab now, or any of this. The numbers are so low to really capture all the events that could happen. And it's really tough, because on one hand, you're like, even with, we were talking about, what was it, endophthalmitis with Ladder. It was like, well, there's two different ways to phrase it, right? You're like, well, there was only 3 cases of it in this trial. And you're like, okay, it's only 3 patients. That's like really low. And then you're like, well, it was 1.7%. And you're like, wow, that sounds really, really high, right? And the truth is like somewhere in between. It's not as bad as it sounds, not as good as it sounds, but it's tough when you're not dealing with numbers equal to the number of patients who are going to be getting this treatment is humongous, given how prevalent AMD and DME are.
Right. Definitely. So, couldn't agree with you more. Yeah.
Thanks for your thoughts. Any final things before we break?
No, I would still say it's still very much an exciting time, and we'll be excited to see where all these things shake out for sure.
Awesome. Fareen Ali, thanks so much for joining me, and I'll talk to you soon.
Thanks, Jay. Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. As always, thank you to Dr. Fareen Ali for joining me. Thanks to Drs. Louis Kai, Angela Chang, and Mike Benincasa for putting together this episode. Thanks to the team at Retina Physician and Penta Vision, including Jennifer Ford, for providing the articles in advance. Remember, you can find this episode and all prior episodes on our website, retinapodcast.com. That's RETINAPodcast.com. There are 217 episodes, including this one, sorted by category. There are multiple ways to access episodes as they come out. You can subscribe on the website. You can access them on your mobile device via the Android or Apple Podcast app. And you can also find these episodes on Facebook and Twitter, and follow us at Retina Podcast on Twitter. You can contact us in many ways. You can email me directly at retinapodcast@gmail.com or by clicking on the Contact Us link on our website. And remember, episode ideas come from you, the listener. Thinks we're doing something well, think we should do something better, just let me know and I'll let our team know. We can always try to kind of improve and use your ideas for future episodes. Thank you, listeners, for what you do on a daily basis, the articles you read and publish, the patient care you provide on a daily basis, and the conversations you inspire here each week. This is Jay Schreeder, signing off.
Good feeling.
This is straight from the cutter's mouth.